You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on our summer music series set list, we'll hear from the Janesville band W's.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. On Tuesday, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump spoke in West Bend, 40 miles from the unrest unfolding in Milwaukee after a fatal police shooting.
Robert Mentzer joins us now to talk about this and other top stories from around Wisconsin this week. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it is great to be back.
Well, let's start with this visit from Donald Trump. Why, do we know why, West Bend?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, so West Bend is one of the places that you would expect Donald Trump to visit. It's an absolute Republican stronghold. It's sort of outside of Milwaukee, is one of the reddest parts of the state. And specifically, it's a place that Trump, as we saw in the Marquette poll last week, needs to shore up his base. So it makes sense as a place just on as a campaign stop. But what happened in this case is his what had already been scheduled stop came just a few days after the police shooting in Milwaukee, the unrest, the rioting, the curfew that followed that. And so Trump sort of fit in the larger discussion and debate about police violence and Black Lives Matter, and so he gave a speech that was billed, I think it was some national media at least, said that it was an attempt to make outreach to African American voters.
Let's give a listen to some of that outreach.
The Democratic Party has failed and betrayed the African American community. Democratic crime policies, education policies, and economic policies have produced only more crime, more broken homes, and more poverty.
Was that an ongoing theme? Democratic Party policies have failed African Americans. Donald Trump and the Republicans can do better?
Right. I'm asking for the vote of every African-American citizen struggling in our country today, Trump said. And the problem, as was pointed out by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and many others, is that West Bend is not Milwaukee. It is not even a suburb of Milwaukee. Washington County has a Black population of 1.2%. So there's a certain, I think, to sort of the national media and the sort of national media conversation, it felt like, well, he's in Wisconsin. It's sort of southeast from Wisconsin's close enough. The speech is covered on TV, so any people of any race can watch and consider those words. But there is something a little just a little odd or a little hollow about speaking to voters in ostensibly in sort of inner city Milwaukee from a place that is not anything like that.
We heard on the show earlier this week, according to some polls, Donald Trump among African American voters running fourth in the race for president behind Hillary Clinton, Gary Johnson, Jill Stein. I guess any moving the needle with the African American community would be a boost for Donald Trump.
Yeah, there have been some polls that had him down to 1% among African Americans. So now so Black voters have historically been a strong Democratic Party constituency. So he's fourth. That is sort of remarkable. But I bet that that second is a quite distant second because the group has traditionally voted strongly for Democrats. But yeah, it certainly shows that his campaign style so far hasn't opened up those inroads.
And another bit of outreach to Wisconsin here. We've seen multiple visits from Donald Trump. We've seen Mike Pence. Tim Kaine on the Democratic side was here the same day for a fundraiser in Wisconsin. A lot of love for Wisconsin from the campaigns.
Yeah, for as long as it lasts, we'll see. If the polls don't tighten, I wonder how much we'll be seeing these candidates in September and October. So enjoy them in August.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin, rounding up some of the top stories in Wisconsin news this week. And this week, Rob, Harley-Davidson, a big Wisconsin brand, agreed to pay a $12 million fine to the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. What happened?
Yes, so Harley-Davidson will pay $12 million. They will chip in an additional $3 million for a air pollution mitigation program through a different EPA program, and they have to stop selling a thing called a super tuner that the government said caused motorcycles to violate air pollution standards. EPA says that Harley sold 340,000 of these things, which are, now, I don't know, it may surprise you to learn, Rob, I'm not really a motorcycle guy myself.
Me neither, I'll admit.
Yeah, but what I learned, basically this is a kit you can use to modify your motorcycle's exhaust system. It makes your motorcycle go faster, which I understand people like and enjoy, but it also makes it pollute more. I went on the Harley's website, and they talk about the Screamin' Eagle Street Performance Tuner, which Harley says is strictly for street legal performance calibrations and EPA compliant performance modifications, which is, I guess, not strictly true. Anyway, so Harley does not admit liability in this settlement. Harley's position here is that that these were only sold for like track racing purposes, and that they called it a good faith compromise with the EPA on areas of law we interpret differently. Harley said that it's you can sell these things for sort of professional racers, and if somebody wants to use it illegally, that's not the company shouldn't be liable for that. But they also made the decision that it was apparently easier or less costly or made more sense for them as a company to take this settlement, pay this money, and stop selling these things.
So the ultimate idea here is if I buy a Harley, it meets EPA standards, and then I buy this aftermarket product, put it on, it runs faster and stronger and less compliant with environmental regulations. If I'm using that for purposes other than racing, that's kind of defeating the spirit of the regulations.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sort of probably some additional scrutiny after the Volkswagen debacle where those cars had a system that was eluding EPA standards, and so this complaint and investigation was filed. I think that there's another part of it that's slightly interesting, that EPA also alleges that Harley sold more than 12,000 motorcycles between 2006 through 2008 models that themselves were not covered by EPA certificate. So you sort of get the sense that maybe there's increased scrutiny on vehicles and emissions.
And finally, Rob, there was an attempt to infiltrate Democratic U.S. Senate candidate and former Senator Russ Feingold's campaign this week that hit the news. What happened?
Yeah, so filed this one under how we do political campaigns in 2016, but Russ Feingold's Senate campaign said that they caught a Republican activist posing as a volunteer. A woman named Allison Moss said she wanted to work on women's health issues and unions, and it turns out that she was a conservative activist, they say, who had written for a right-wing website aimed at college campuses and who previously had tried to go undercover on Hillary Clinton's campaign in Iowa. So they kicked her out, and that won't be happening, but it's sort of a piece with the type of kind of infiltration stunts that have been pulled by other really activists on the right and the left. There's a sense that if you can get behind closed doors, you can really get the good dirt and sort of make a splash for your political side.
Well, watch out for more cloak and dagger political reporting in the future, Rob. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Robert Menser. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday at this time to round up some of the top news stories from around Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a teacher asked her students what they wished she knew about them. And their answers range from funny to profound to heartbreaking. We'll talk to her about how their answers changed the way she approached teaching.
First, we continue our summer music series set list. Today, we feature the Janesville band Double U's, who recently stopped by WPR to perform a set of songs in our studio.
The group's singer, Wilden Hughes, tells us how working on his family's farm influences the songs he writes and how the band fits into the Janesville music scene. W's, thanks a lot for joining us up here in the studio.
Thank you.
I want to start with the origin story of the band and how it all came together. Wilden, let's start with you. I understand some of the music came from cassettes you'd recorded before the band existed.
Yeah. So I came back to my hometown, which is Janesville, Wisconsin, around 2009. And I moved out into a house in the country that is on my family's farm that was a little dilapidated, and I just kind of moved out there and was all alone. Had my own space and had some pretty rudimentary recording skills, and just kind of started there.
And Max, where did it go next? This guy came up waving cassette tapes at you, or how did those turn into the music?
No, actually, an old band of mine called Wake Up Sleepy Giant was playing around town, and he was performing solo at that point. And you went through a few different iterations before I joined the band. My friend Dan played drums in the band for a little while, and then Jeremy joined, and then I ended up joining to play bass.
This layered sound you had, how did that all come together for the three of you?
I think the genesis of it was just trying to connect the digital and the analog and kind of experimenting in ways in which we can draw from both, you know, the advantages of both, you know, the disadvantages of both, kind of really learning the equipment. And we've spent the last few years just, you know, trying to perfect it, trying to piece it together and really find our sound. So that's kind of what we're doing.
Yeah, I should paint a picture here. We've got a bank of technology in front of us with boards and keyboards and things like that. But then Max has a bass guitar. Wilden has a guitar. Max, you've got a couple drums next to you. So that's that digital analog hybrid. You do it recorded and live.
Yeah, and we're using equipment that I think a lot of people use to make dance music. But we're trying to, I guess, take that artificial stuff and using it to make something that sounds a little more natural.
And it's electronic music, sort of, and it's coming from a farm, at least at the beginning. And I think you've done some of the recording at a farm. Somebody, I think, called it Electronica Americana or something like that. But does the farm influence the music that comes out?
Yeah, it sure does. Maybe less so the farm, but more so an Americana tone. This feeling of wanting to tell a story, wanting to connect with someone who has experienced the same things I have, or is maybe experiencing something parallel to what I'm doing, but in just a completely different way or completely different perspective. And so that's what I'm trying to arrive at, is some sort of, I guess, intersection between the future of music, the past of music, just kind of trying to stitch it all together.
Spend a little more time on the farm. I understand, Wilden, this is not a new farm. This has been in your family for something like six generations, since the 1840s.
Wilden Hughes the sixth.
Sixth, right. I mean, I can't imagine. I've never been, I've been rooted in a place for what seemed like a long time, a couple decades, but that's nothing. So what's it like growing up and then coming back and making music on this place that your family's been in so long?
It's kind of weird. I think growing up, there was obviously a lot of, I made it maybe a little bit of a bigger deal in my head than it really is. We all go back six generations, so I'm not the only one there. But I definitely felt the weight of, you know, wanting to honor and wanting to carry on, you know, a tradition. And so I've always been, I think, uniquely aware of, I mean, just thinking of, you know, the fence lines, how long have those fence lines been there, and what stories, you know, are around those. And I'm very lucky and very blessed to have that. But at the same time, I'm just like my buddies, and I don't feel that different. You know, I don't think about it too much.
Just on the farm, I understand you still do some work on there. So is your day checklist, you know, mend the fence, lay down some samples, milk the cow, record a guitar track.
It's a little different. You know, it's made, like yesterday I was installing moisture sensor probes, so I was digging down into the earth and digging all these rocks and sand out and putting these PVC sensors connected to a solar panel with a GSM cellular network, and I'm trying to connect them to that so I can go home and see how the moisture is, you know, on the soil profile and stuff like that. So there is, you know, everything is changing, not just music. Agriculture is changing. You know, everyday life is changing for all of us, and I think we're all just in the middle of it.
Yeah, Willie shows me sometimes the new technology they're using on the farm, and it's pretty amazing to see, like the topographical maps and like the drones and everything, like controlling the Google Glass, controlling the sprayers from the iPad. I mean, it's
People think farming, rustic, back to the basics kind of stuff. It's one of the most high tech things out there.
It really, especially you know, even in the last 5 years, the things that have come along, and it's just getting started. So.
The music that you're doing is a mix of the technology and sort of the organic and older fashioned stuff. And Jeremy, I want to bring you in to talk a little bit about, you guys record this stuff and you can see how it all works in the studio. That's not necessarily something I would think that would be easy to perform live. So how do you take what you've done and turn it into a live performance?
Yeah, I mean, on the computer, it's easy to just go in and make sure everything lines up. But when you're playing live, it's a lot different. Everything's kind of on the line. So I think now we've gotten to a pretty good spot where we've got our machines all synced up and ready to go. And
yeah, and with your music, it seems like clearly playing live, some of it is sequenced, so it's kind of locked in. Mm-hmm. And you guys improvise some, and you're playing instruments live. It seems like there's the potential for everything to go off the rails. Did that happen some in the early experiments?
Oh, no, it still goes off the rails all the time. I mean, gosh, you know, it's no different than a three-piece rock band,
really?
Too.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's the same thing.
Sure,
you know,
any band can have a train wreck live, no matter the instrumentation.
Right, you're still, like, at the end of the day, what you're doing is missing cues.
But this way you can blame the robots.
Mm-hmm. But, well, you know, everything, we can start and stop everything together. We can take anything and play it forwards or backwards, and so we have this ability to sort of stretch time, you know, in the set. So we can really, once we get comfortable with that, and once it gets fluid, it has a mind of its own.
I want to talk about performing a little more. You used to host outdoor shows, Wilden, on the farm. Is that right? Do you still do this?
Yeah, well, so I lived at that farmhouse for a year, and then I moved out of that house and into I bought a new house, and at that place I had a little more space. And so, you know, we just sort of got together with friends and organized the Rock County Folk Symposium, and we did it for 5 years, and we had a lot of great bands. A lot of the Madison music scene was really represented there, and it was a blast to do for 5 years.
You say some of the people came down from Madison. I know you're a Madison Rock County hybrid. Is there a Rock County scene? Is there a Janesville music scene?
You know, there is. I have to admit that I don't participate in it, but there is. You know, Janesville's it's an interesting town. There's a lot of qualities about Janesville that sort of represent who we are, you know, as a state. A lot of good people from there, and it's just a good honest blue-collar town, and I think the music scene there really reflects that, which I think we don't maybe necessarily fit in, which is maybe why we don't participate as much. It's so much easier to come to Madison and get amazing experiences like this or the bevy of other spaces and stuff to perform.
Wilden, looking ahead at the future of Double U's, what are your goals? What is success for you as a musician with this project?
I think success for me is always putting out albums. That's the benchmark for me. It's not necessarily about touring or playing a ton of shows or, you know, being super well known, but just releasing really solid albums that, you know, I'll be able to look back on and really be proud of. I think that's sort of my singular goal, is to really create something that will last forever.
All right, this might be a hard question. Why? I mean, you've recorded those cassettes, you're doing those albums. What is it that drives you to do this and complete these projects? Look deep into your soul.
I think it maybe comes back a little bit to my environment and where I see myself. I think I find myself at times incredibly inspired and proud of, life on the farm, life in Janesville. And sometimes, I yearn for more. And so this is a way for me to create that.
It's a Rock County soundtrack.
It's a Rock County soundtrack.
Guys, thanks a lot for playing in the studio for us today.
Thank you.
That was the Janesville band Double U's. You can catch them live August 25th at the High Noon Saloon in Madison.
Setlist Summer Music Series airs every Friday at this time through Labor Day weekend. Support for Setlist comes from Hyde Music. For more about the artists featured on Setlist, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to WPR.org/setlist.
Coming up, we'll talk to a teacher whose whole approach to teaching changed after asking a simple question of her students. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's The Political Junkie with Ken Rudin. Tonight, Ken and his guests look at American political dynasties, women in politics, and the contentious media life of Donald Trump. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, the beginning of the school year is just around the corner for students in Wisconsin and around the country.
For students, it can be an exciting time or a time of anxiety.
A few years ago, an elementary school teacher based in Denver started an exercise to get to know her students. She had them complete a simple sentence on a post-it note. I wish my teacher knew blank. And the responses she received surprised her.
Some of the responses were funny, some of them were poignant, and some of them were heartbreaking confessions of things like issues at home, including deportations and struggles with poverty.
Kyle Schwartz joins us now. She teaches third grade at Dowell Elementary School in Denver, and she's the author of the book, I Wish My Teacher Knew Blank, How One Question Can Change Everything for Our Kids. Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, first of all, tell us a little bit about Dowell Elementary School, where you teach.
Well, I actually just came from there. We're setting up our classroom, and we have kids coming on Monday. But Dowell Elementary is in southwest Denver. As far as demographics go, we are about between 90 and 95% free and reduced lunch, which is a marker for poverty. It means that the students who qualify for free and reduced lunch, they live at or very near the poverty line. But we also have about half of our students who speak a language other than English at home, which we definitely see as an asset. And, you know, we have a really strong community of teachers and families and students who are all just working real hard and doing our best and learning every day.
And this project, asking kids to complete the sentence, I wish my teacher knew blank, how did you come up with that and what were you looking to find out?
You know, I started doing it in my first year of teaching, and I really just wanted a way to connect with students. And I think in some ways I didn't know what I didn't know. So instead of making assumptions about my students, I just let them tell me, what is it that's important for me to know as a teacher? What is it that I would need to know? And I think it really kind of goes to this universal desire for teachers and students to build relationships together, and it certainly helped me in my classroom. And once I shared it, I've heard from teachers really all over the world who have tried it in their classroom as well and had great results.
Talk about some of the responses that your third grade students gave to this exercise.
So one thing I talk about in the book, I give a really detailed teacher guide so that if anyone wants to try the same exercise in their class, they've kind of got all my tips and strategies. And really kids are able, I tell them like right from the beginning, you know, you can take this seriously, you can be funny about it. So some kids say things like, I wish my teacher knew how to do a backflip, or I wish my teacher knew more about velociraptors. but other times kids are kind of able to tell you a little bit more, to tell you about something that may be closer to the heart. So I've heard from students, I wish my teacher knew I don't have pencils at home to do my homework, or I wish my teacher knew that my reading log is not signed because my mom's not around a lot. And I also hear, I wish my teacher knew I want to go to college. So they're really able to be what adults would consider vulnerable, but they're very really able to tell you what you need to know.
And when they tell you these things, do you know their identities? Are you able to directly help these kids, or do you just have to be aware of that problem as a whole as something that could be affecting any student?
I think something that surprises most people is I do leave it up to kids that they can be anonymous if they want, or, you know, they can write their name on it. But actually, it was my students who were like, we want to share these out loud to the class. Like, when can I read mine out loud? And I think it surprises most adults that, you know, that kids really want to tell people this. And so we all sat around the rug and, you know, I've had an experience with a kid who, you know, got halfway through sharing his note and kind of broke down in tears and passed it to another kid to share. And he just wanted to tell the class that he wished his teacher knew that his dad left. And it's those type of really powerful moments in a classroom that can, you know, not only just inform a teacher of, you know, something I need to know, but also to have kids display empathy for each other, have kids support each other, have kids know that, you know, these things that they're struggling with don't have to be a secret. You know, we can create a community and we can be a support for each other.
And speaking of empathy, you write that doing this exercise kind of took you back to your own days in school after a family move. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. You know, as a teacher, I kind of reflect back on my own school experience, and I really struggled in school. I had a very difficult time relating to my peers. I had a very challenging relationship with teachers. I was like that kid who was constantly, quote, like in trouble all the time. And so for me to become an elementary school teacher is already a shock. But it helped me understand that, you know, when my family, we moved from a small town in central Illinois to like a big suburb in Denver. And so that's a huge cultural shift for a kid to navigate. And I didn't do it well. I was like really confused about all these new things and like the different culture of the school and the different attitudes of the kids. So it was really difficult for me to connect in school. And, you know, it's something I can realize looking back that that's kind of where the problem stemmed from, is I never really made those relationships. I never really felt safe or secure in that new environment. And so it helps me have empathy for my students. You know, even like kind of it being hard to wake up early to go back to school, like I kind of think in my head, oh, you know, like it is hard for me to wake up and get to school right now. And that's how my kids are thinking. And that's what they're experiencing now, too.
We're talking with Kyle Swartz right now, third grade teacher at Dowell Elementary in Denver, Colorado. She's the author of the book, I Wish My Teacher Knew, How One Question Can Change Everything for Our Kids. And you talked about needing those relationships as the fundamental building block to taking care of the kid as a learner and also as a person. How do you build those relationships?
So I think that that's an important thing for people to know is, like, just how quintessential relationships in a classroom are. And as teachers, we know, like, the work of being a teacher is building relationships. It's getting to know children and getting to push them in their own individual ways and getting to challenge them and getting to support them. And so we do this as teachers in a variety of ways. You know, there's a million little things that we do every day in our classroom that help us connect with kids. And that's really what I wanted to put in the book. So each chapter kind of focuses on an issue that could arise in a classroom, such as student mobility when kids move around a lot, certainly poverty, grief. And I talked about some of the things that I do for kids. So like one strategy that I have is to really start with relationships. So to when a student comes in that's new, like I already have all my logistics set up for them. I are prepare to have new kids come in through having welcome kits. And so I can really start with a relationship. That's one strategy I use. Another strategy I use is really allowing kids who have been through an adverse childhood experience or a trauma or grief to write about that, to share that, and to support other students with that. So there's a lot of little ways that we go about creating relationships with students every day in our classrooms. And I really tried to highlight very actionable steps that teachers can take in their classroom to start those relationships, you know, when they have a challenging time, to go to one of these teacher tools in the book and use it with their students.
Yeah, you get into really practical nuts and bolts things. Like you mentioned, welcoming a new student in the book, you write, instead of saying, find a seat, you say, here's your seat. Because that social pressure of where do I sit, who do I sit by, the new kid has to figure out. But if you just set them somewhere, that you've resolved that issue for them.
Yeah, and I think it's just the kind of these really, I guess, common sense measures, but in naming it and pointing it out, and this is what teachers are doing to support students are really important. So when a new student comes in, you know, I start with, I'm glad you're here. You know, this is a good place for you. This is a good school for you. And I am glad you're in this place. And sit here and help out. Like, here's how to help our classroom, whether it be just like turning out the lights or helping push in the chairs, something that a kid can do so that they become an active member of the community. And it's those little things that they seem so small, but they make such a difference for kids.
And you are open about times in your career when you may have made a misstep in what you were trying to do for kids. For instance, there was one child that loved science and was really passionate about science, and you set up a science camp and arranged for him, I think, to have a scholarship, and then it didn't work out. Tell us what happened and how you dealt with that.
Yeah, I was just reconnecting with that student a couple months ago, but he was the type of student who was just always into science. He would tell you anything you needed to know, and I really wanted to nurture that love of science for him, and I found a science camp that would give him a scholarship to go, and, you know, told him and his mom about it, and everyone was really excited, but when it came down to it, the family didn't have the resources to get him there. They didn't have the transportation. They didn't have that daily ability to get him to and from the science camp. So it's something I kind of point to in the book as where, like, our perceptions or assumptions as teachers can kind of get us in trouble, where we're not really seeing the full story, or we're not really seeing the barriers that students have, or perhaps we're not really seeing the resources that students come to school with. So I definitely speak to some of my missteps as a teacher, but I think all teachers are really powerful when we're reflective and when we're thinking back on what worked and what didn't work and how can I get better. You know, ego is kind of the enemy of teaching, because we're always developing our professional practice and we're always looking to improve and serve students better.
We're talking with Kyle Swartz right now. She's a third grade teacher and the author of I Wish My Teacher Knew, How One Question Can Change Everything for Our Kids. And she's joining us now to talk about asking a simple question of her students and how that changed her teaching philosophy.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Looking back, was there something you wish your teacher knew? Or if you're a parent, what do you wish your children's teachers knew about your family, your kid, and teachers? What do you think about what you're hearing? How do you build relationships with your students? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with third grade teacher Kyle Swartz. She started a project that asked her students to tell her one thing that they wish she knew about them. Their answers range from funny to poignant to heartbreaking. And the project became a viral sensation around the world. Her new book is called I Wish My Teacher Knew How One Question Can Change Everything for Our Kids.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a teacher, what kind of challenges do the kids face in your classroom? Something that maybe people might not expect looking in from the outside. How do you deal with it? How do you reach out to that kid and their family? If you are a student or looking back at your days as a kid, if you had the opportunity to tell your teacher something they should know about you, something that would make a difference, what would you tell them? If you're a parent, what do you wish your children's teacher knew about you, your family, your kid? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or join the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Kyle, going back to that first experiment with this question, I wish my teacher knew, why did you decide to start sharing these stories, opening up and letting other people read them on social media?
Well, you know, it was kind of a little accidental. I had just kind of started tweeting and getting into Twitter, like maybe for 2 weeks. And I found one of the old notes that my student had written, and it was the one that said, I wish my teacher knew I don't have pencils at home to do my homework. And as I was kind of picking up that old piece of paper, it just kind of touched my heart again. And I thought, you know, like, let me invite other teachers to try this exercise too. And so, you know, that's kind of how it started. I just put one up and I just told other teachers to try this in their classroom. And I was really surprised and excited when I saw teachers from across the country, people I didn't even know, trying it in their classroom and having such great results with their kids. You know, I just heard from a teacher in Pakistan who's doing it with her students. I've heard from people who are working with refugees in Greece who are doing it with students. And I even read about a teacher in Iraq recently who did this with his students and found out that they were kind of coming to school hungry and started a meal program for them. So it's been crazy how far that it's spread. But I think it kind of speaks to the power that our students' voices have. And when we empower our students to share their truth, then we can empower them to advocate for themselves. And I think that has been just a great lesson that's come out of this.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Kelly is on the line in Madison. Kelly, hi.
Hi. I was just telling your producer that I've taught in Tanzania, in Colombia, and Wisconsin, and something that is universal of all of the students is really they just want to be known. They just want to feel like somebody cares about them, and through investing time at the beginning of the year, by getting to know them on a really personal level, and also being vulnerable with them and telling them things. I think oftentimes as teachers, we want to put ourselves on a pedestal. We want to be seen as perfect, but I think the number one thing that I've learned is sharing my own weaknesses has opened up that dialogue.
Interesting, Kelly. Thanks for that call. Kyle, what do you think, first of all, about that last idea of sharing your own weaknesses as a teacher?
Oh, yes. I think that's so essential. And, you know, just as teachers, we're not going to be perfect. So, but acknowledging that, and I apologize to my students often, you know, like, hey, I got this wrong, or, you know, I shouldn't have gotten so frustrated. And the wonderful thing is that kids are so forgiving with you. And, you know, if when we can do that, when we can, like, reflect on what we could have done better, and we can be open and vulnerable with our students, you know, that really creates a community in the classroom. And I totally agree with her. Like, our students just want to be known. Like, they just want to be valued. And that is something we can give to them in schools. It's something we can do, and it's something we should do.
You were talking about children who come to school hungry, and I know that's something that's affected and affects the children that you work with too. And one of the things you've done is implement a grab drawer for food and snacks, and they can just take whatever's in there, no questions asked. Do you think your teaching has changed a lot now that you know all this about your students that you never would have known before?
Yeah, I think definitely my teaching has learned and evolved, and just to make sure that like the needs of my students are being met. And in order to meet those needs, you know, especially those basic needs, they need to be met before they can learn. And so I've definitely, you know, evolved and changed. And I think some people have said like, oh, you know, this must have all been new information in these notes. This must have all been a surprise. And I do have to say, I wasn't really naive to the challenges my students were facing, but it was really telling when a student would share something with me, like perhaps, I wish my teacher knew my parents were going through divorce. You know, I already knew it. The student already knew that. But like, that was still the most, like, salient thing on that student's mind. Like, that was still the thing that she wanted to tell me. And I think that's really telling, too.
Talking to Kyle Swartz, elementary school teacher. Her book is called I Wish My Teacher Knew How One Question Can Change Everything for Our Kids. Back to our callers now with Barbara in Milwaukee. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say, in response to what the teacher said, when you're making a special spot for a kid maybe who's new in the class, how important those words are. My brother, who is in his 60s now, as am I, told me recently how when he had to switch from a Catholic school to a public school, that my dad told him, I called the principal at Groveland School, and they have a spot for you. And here my brother just looked so happy about that 55 years later, and I was so touched and how my dad had handled that and how he felt, you know, that was a great thing and he belonged there.
Barbara, thanks so much for that call. And Kyle, 55 years later, this, what in hindsight might look like a small gesture, can make a really big difference. Do you think those little efforts by a parent and the teacher on the other end of that phone make a difference like that?
Oh, I definitely do. I definitely think that the climate and the culture of our classrooms can impact students like long after the fact. When we're, you know, as teachers, when we're faced with so many challenges, you know, when our students come to school hungry, when, you know, they've been through some traumatic or adverse childhood experiences that are still impacting them, when, you know, they're having difficulty with relationships and a parent isn't able to be present, like those are all really big things to deal with. But I still believe that, you know, a caring adult, an adult who's empathetic, who is genuine, and who has an unconditional positive regard for their students, I think the impact of that can be carried with a child long, long after. And that's what keeps me going as a teacher. And, you know, I know that there's teachers all over Wisconsin now that have had that, been that person for a child. And I think that it's great that people are starting to recognize the role that teachers are playing, not just in our classroom, but in our society, in growing these kids and nurturing our children.
Do you think there's any danger here that too much of the burden on knowing the circumstances of the child and their family and the financial well-being and their nutritional well-being is falling or could fall on the teacher, when really there might be bigger picture things that we need to do at a state and a national level to make sure that we know our students and we know our students' needs?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, first of all, you know, like as a teacher, I definitely feed kids. I've gone and bought shoes for kids. You know, I've done these things. And these are like small band-aid steps. And they're addressing an immediate need. But as teachers, you know, we are really on the front lines of especially childhood poverty, when we have now more than 50% of kids in American public schools live below or very near to the poverty line. We are at the front lines of this, and we see it going on every day. For us as teachers, the political becomes very personal. Those policies that are enacted on, you know, our local, state, and national level, those all trickle down, and we see its effect in real kids, in real humans every single day. And I am really hopeful for the day when teachers are seen as experts on, you know, policy matters involving children. I think oftentimes teachers aren't even seen as experts in education.
Kyle, you know, we need to leave it there. Kyle, mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Kyle Swartz. She teaches third grade in Denver, and she's the author of the book we've been talking about, I Wish My Teacher Knew How One Question Can Change Everything for Our Kids.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrer. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.